This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Claire Massoud is one of the most unflinching and unafraid novelists at work today. She is the author of 5 novels, including The Emperor's Children and The Woman Upstairs, and a dedicated professor and a champion of the written word. Her newest novel, The Burning Girl, is a really uncanny achievement in voice. Young Julia's story of her troubled friend Cassie teems with the intense, desperate experience of youth, the feelings of loss of safety, and the painful regrets of growing up. Once you've read it, you will not forget it, I promise you. Please help me welcome Claire Massoud to Politics and Prose.
Thank you so much, Liz. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. I'll put my stuff down. It's an especial treat. Thank you, friends and new faces. I used to live in D.C. when my husband's British, and when we moved from the U.K. To the States, we moved to Washington. And it would be 22 years ago, right around now, that I gave, I think, my first reading, my first American, and maybe my first ever reading here in this bookstore. And Carla Cohen introduced me, and she was amazing and scary. So this place has a real, is very special to me. And thank you so much for having me back. I don't get to live here anymore, but it's wonderful to visit. So what I thought I would do is sort of tell you just a little bit about the book, and then read three short sections, and then answer any questions that you might have. The Burning Girl is a novel that I was saying for a time, I've said for years, like, you know, being a writer is like being a magpie. You take, you know, your eyeglasses and your scarf and, you know, that sign back there, and you put them together. I've come to think of it latterly as a little more like composting, right? Because you put everything together and you hope it will develop into something organic and that it will grow. And this book for me, which is a book, it's narrated by Julia Robertson, who is, when she's telling the story, she's going into her senior year of high school. But she's looking back on events that start the summer after sixth grade. And she's telling the story of what happened with her best friend, her lifelong best friend, Cassie Burns. And it's about the unraveling of that friendship. It's also, for me, about how we tell stories and the ways in which we think we know one another and may know one another intimately, but how much we don't know, and partly what it's like to know somebody intimately and then not see them so much anymore and still feel that you know them, but not necessarily in a day-to-day way know what their life is like. And that's something that happens between friends. It's also something that happens in between lovers, when lovers part, you know, and you think, but I know him so well, and then, you know, but do you? But the impulse to sort of write the story now came from a few things. One was a story, that latter part of this project, that sort of sense of the making up of stories, was with me because of something that happened when I was a kid. And when I was a kid, we lived in Sydney, Australia, until I was 9, and then we moved to Canada. And in those days, the way you kept in touch with people was by writing letters, and so I had pen pals. My friends became my pen pals. And we corresponded over a number of years. I don't still have the letters, and they probably, if I can guess, they probably began, "Hi, how are you? I'm sorry I haven't written in so long," right? Like, every letter begins that way. But we did keep in touch, and through these friends that I was in touch with, I eventually heard fragments of a story of something that happened to another classmate of ours. And our school had been very small, and we were all friends together. And this one girl, there was a whole series of things that went on in her life, and tragically she died. And I was aware even then of the strangeness of not really ever, like, I had to fill in the blanks. It was like the Gospels. I had these pieces, and then I had to sort of try to figure out a broader story, or what I understood to be the broader story. And I was aware that over time that haunted me, that sort of strangeness of that experience, and how important it was to me to feel I knew what had happened, and also the impossibility of ever knowing what had happened. And latterly, just in the past few months, after writing the book, I was writing an article in which I mentioned this, and they wanted to fact check, and so they had somebody go through the digitized editions of the Sydney Morning Herald for basically a year and a half, because I said it was around this time. They went through for a year and a half in 1980, and they found the newspaper announcement of what of this girl's death and what had happened, and it bore absolutely no relation whatsoever to the story that I had in my head. And that was pretty interesting. And my first impulse was to think, wow, I guess I just made it up entirely. And then I thought, no, that's just the official story, right? And the official story was just a separate version again. It was never, you know, none of them is really what went on. And given that the people who were telling me were kids, and their parents probably didn't tell them everything, right? Who knows? Who knows now what went on? We have an official record. We have my sort of faulty imaginary version, which isn't this. You know, this isn't that story. And then the other thing that prompted the writing of this book was having teenage kids and watching, in particular, I mean, we have nieces and nephews, but watching in particular our daughter go through these years of adolescence. And she's now a junior in high school, and luckily life is easier by the time you're a junior, a little bit easier. But to be a parent and to see these things happening that bring back such powerful memories for you of what, you know, of what I lived through, and the friends I lost along the way, and yet as a parent you're not really invited to say anything except, you know, I'm here, but there's so much that you can't ask about, and there's a lot of sort of whatever impulses you may have to impart wisdom, your best bet is to just bite your tongue. So it was a very intense thing to live in palimpsest, to have my experiences coming back to me and be watching her experiences, and to realize that even though the world has changed a great deal emotionally, the experiences haven't changed. That, you know, that the intensity and the passion, just like we read Othello and we recognize the emotions, even if we don't have a doublet and hose, you know, we recognize the emotions. So I thought what I would do is read just a little bit right from very near the beginning, and then a little bit from later on. And again, this is Julia telling the story she's just about to begin her senior year. Not that that matters, it won't come up. It's a different story depending on where you start. Who's good, who's bad, what it all means. Each of us shapes our stories so they make sense of who we think we are. I can begin when Cassie and I were best friends, or I can begin when we weren't anymore, or I can begin at the dark end and tell it all backward. There's no beginning before, though. Cassie and I met at nursery school, and I can't remember a time when I didn't know her, when I didn't pick her sleek white head out of a crowd and know exactly where she was in a room and think of her some ways as mine. Cassie was tiny with bones like a bird. She was always the smallest girl in the class, and the span of her ankle was the span of my wrist. She had shiny white blonde hair, almost albino, she was so fair, her skin translucent and a little pink. But you'd be wrong to mistake her size and pallor for frailty. All you had to do was to look into her eyes, still blue eyes that turned gray in dark weather like the water in the quarry, and you could see that she was tough. Strong, I guess, is a better word, although, of course, in the end, she wasn't strong enough. But even when we were small, she had a quality about her, a what the hell, an I'm not chicken, are you sort of way. According to my mother and to Cassie's mother, Bev, Cassie, and I became friends in the second week of nursery when we were 4 years old. That was always the story, though I can't tell now whether I remember it or have just been told so many times that I invented the memory. I was playing with a group of kids in the sandbox, and Cassie stood in the middle of the playground, hands at her sides like a zombie, staring at everything, not apparently nervous, but totally detached. I left my friends to come touch her elbow, and I said, so I was told, "Hey, come build a castle with me?" And she broke into that rare, broad smile of hers, a famous smile made all the better when she was bigger by the Georgia Jagger gap between her front teeth. She came with me back to the sandbox. And that, my mother always said, was that. So the book is divided into three parts, and in the first part it tells the story of the summer after summer between sixth and seventh grade, and it's a time when they are still in childhood or clinging still to childhood, and even though probably in front of everybody else they wouldn't play imaginary games, they do when they're together. And then the third part is in ninth grade, and it's when they're supposedly passed into some sort of more grown-up time in their lives when they don't make up stories, but of course they do in a different way. And part two, I sort of think of, it sounds a little pretentious, but I think of it like Virginia Woolf, The Middle of To the Lighthouse, time passes, right? The middle section is time passes, and it's about this transition, the time between being a kid and being some early version of an adult. This is from the beginning of the second part. My mother assures me that it happens to everyone sooner or later, for reasons more or less identifiable. Everyone loses a best friend at some point. Not in the she moved to Tucson sense, but in the sense that we grew apart. I, who pride myself on seeing things, can't even now properly sort out what happened. Cassie had her version, though she never told it to me, and when much later I asked her outright, "What happened to us?" is how I put it, which seemed more neutral than I felt. She looked at me a long time, a look I'd describe as hurt, though I was the one who'd been wronged, surely, and shook her head slightly. When I gave her a chance to explain, that was the best she could do. Seventh grade is difficult for most. My parents said it was the time of life they'd least like to live again, which wasn't helpful, as I had no choice but to live it. But seventh grade is differently difficult for each person. For Zach Filkins, it was difficult because they didn't have a middle school math class challenging enough for him, and he had to go over to the high school to join the advanced freshmen. On the other hand, Zach wasn't interested in going to the middle school prom, so didn't ask anyone, and didn't have to contemplate the possibility of rejection. Whereas Brent O'Connor, a nice guy, but in seventh grade he still didn't break 5 feet, had to brave the humiliation of being turned down for the dance by three girls, one of whom was me. I was already 5'6". It was impossible. Then there was the slightly different challenge of being Alicia Homans, the fourth girl he asked, who knew it, but who accepted cheerfully and held her head as high as if she'd been his first choice. There are the social struggles and the agonies and embarrassments of puberty. I won't forget the mixture of triumph and pity I felt when Bridget Mulvaney flounced down the corridor, tossing her famous auburn curls with a period stain the size of a saucer on her purple gypsy skirt. And the weight of the world that falls upon each of us in varying degrees as we finally relinquish childhood's clouds of glory to live ever after in our earthly realm. In seventh grade, Jude Robin lived up to his name and was arrested for shoplifting a camera from Walmart. Andrew Dre got a caution from his law enforcement uncle for weed smoking and small-time dealing. Rumor had it that Stacey Billich gave blowjobs to half a dozen guys in one night at Tessa Rubin's party in late May of that year, and the struggle for Stacey was that it didn't matter whether the rumor was true. There was no point loudly denying it because that meant no more as a truth or a falsehood than did the original story. In seventh grade, we moved suddenly into a world of adult actions and adult conjecture. It was also a world of adult consciousness, with all the strangeness that implies. Like my mother's story about Cassie and me, is that our paths, always destined to diverge, simply took their natural course. It was a given, for example, that I'd eventually go to college, because my parents assumed I would, but also because I wanted to, because I was good at school and proud of it, and couldn't imagine not going on to more school after school. Even when I dreamed of being a pop star, I imagined going to NYU or UCLA in between performances. But Cassie's mother hadn't gone to college for the pleasure of learning. She'd studied nursing only later in her mid-20s, right before she had Cassie. She left school at 18 and worked as a waitress, and then in the hat and glove department at Macy's, apparently, which always surprised me because I thought of department store staff as tidy and elegant. Cassie wasn't especially good at school, and she didn't like it enough to work at it, and by seventh grade, this had consequences. We'd left the elementary for the middle school up Route 29, not far from the animal shelter. For those of us from Royston, middle school was just 2 years because Royston Elementary had a sixth grade, but a lot of the other kids from neighboring towns had already been there a year. The school building, gray concrete, unlike our cozy old Victorian elementary school downtown, squatted in an enormous parking lot between two strip malls. Its astroturf fields glowed curiously green in all seasons. But mostly we lived in the locker-lined, windowless hallways, all of us lumpy and greasy in the fluorescence. Kids from the other towns seemed bigger and older than the kids we knew. Whereas before, school had felt like a cheerful, dysfunctional family, we'd known most of our classmates all our lives, now it felt like a parade ground, a theater of strange performances. Suddenly we didn't share the same schedules or teachers or classrooms. Scattered, we didn't necessarily even arrive or leave together. Cassie and I were pushed apart by bureaucracy. I got put in advanced math and advanced English, and while the school didn't technically have an advanced history class, Cassie and I were in different sections, and mysteriously she was in with the troublemakers like Stacy Billich and Andrew Dre, while I was in with Mei Huang and Zach Filkins and Angie Pitts, the daughter of Mr. Pitts, the high school AP history teacher. Cassie and I were together only for PE and orchestra, where she played the flute and I played the cello, and we sat on opposite sides of the room anyhow. That's what my mother felt happened, and maybe partly she was right. But I blamed the new girl from two towns over, Delia Vossel, whom I quickly took to calling the evil morsel. At first, Cassie laughed, and we made fun of Delia together. She had orangey blonde blow-dried hair, bulging push-up bras, and shiny lip gloss, and a way of glancing at boys out of the corner of her sleepy almond eye as if she were Sofia Vergara starring in a TV show invisible to anyone but herself. But Delia and Cassie had history and math and English together, and by the beginning of October they had study dates, which, as I said to my mom, seemed mostly to involve going to Rite Aid. Cassie tried to tell me that actually Delia was really nice and funny. She said she was funny when anyone could tell the girl had the sense of humor of a brick. Then it turned out that Delia liked to sing, that she too wanted to be a pop star and planned to audition for the spring musical, though when she sang Adele in the cafeteria and Cassie, admiring, flashed her gap-toothed grin, her voice was thin and raspy and she sang flat and couldn't tell. Mr. Montgomery, the music teacher, apparently couldn't tell either because he gave Delia the solo part in the chorus, which we were to perform at the holiday assembly in December. I probably shouldn't have told Cassie that Montgomery only wanted to jump Delia's bones, but I did. In the old days, Cassie would have agreed with me, or at least she would have laughed. But in thrall to Delia, she just bit her lip and looked away. And then I'll read one last section. Sometimes I felt that growing up and being a girl was about learning to be afraid. Not paranoid exactly, but always alert and aware, like checking out the exits in the movie theater or the fire escape in a hotel. You came to know, in a way you hadn't as a kid, that the body you inhabited was vulnerable, imperfectly fortified. On TV, in the papers, in books and movies, it isn't ever men being raped or kidnapped or bludgeoned or dismembered or burned with acid. But in stories and crime shows and TV series and movies and in life too, it's going on all the time, all around you. So you learn in your mind that your body needs to be protected. It's both precious and totally dispensable depending on whom you encounter. You don't want to end up at a party not knowing how to get home. You don't want to end up walking down a street, especially a quiet street, by yourself at night. You don't want to open your door to a strange man at all, really, ever, if you're alone, even if he's wearing a uniform, because his uniform could be a disguise. It happens. I've seen it on TV. You start to grow up, and you learn from all the stories around you what the world is like, and you start to lose freedoms. Not because anybody actually tells you that you've lost them, but because you know you need to take care. Without a friend beside you, no biking on the Audubon Trail, no swimming at the quarry, no hiking in the woods. Beware darkness, isolation, the outdoors, unlocked windows, men you don't know. And then you realize, too, that even men you know or thought you knew might not be okay. A math teacher that fall at a high school in nearby New Hampshire was caught in an FBI sting with thousands of kiddie porn images on his computer, pictures of little girls kept in cages, someone said. A rabbi in Boston was caught spying on the women of his congregation in their ritual baths. The guy who owned the diner we'd sometimes gone to on our way back from the beach, less than half an hour from our house, was accused of sexually harassing his waitresses and forcing one, or was it three, or five, they kept coming out of the woodwork, it had gone on for years apparently, to have sex with him. So when I remembered the harried woman in tight mom jeans who'd served us the last time, memorable for a strawberry birthmark the size of a gumball on her right cheek, and for the fact that, with her heavily outlined china blue eyes, she was otherwise notably pretty, or had been, until life had ground her down and worn her out prematurely, furrowing her skin. I remembered her and wondered if she was one of them, if she'd been forced onto her knees in the pantry after hours, or whether the birthmark had spared her, like what Cassie had told me about the sign from God at Passover, whether her flaw had proven her blessed protection. You get to middle school and you think about these things. The world opens up, history stretches behind you, and the future stretches before you, and you're suddenly aware of the wild, unknowable interior lives of everyone around you, the realization that each and every person lives in an unspoken world as full and strange as your own, and that you can't ever hope entirely to know anything, not even yourself. But just as the world is opening up, it's closing too, and things reveal their previously unimagined shapes. Without it being said, I was treated as a kid with a bright future, and Cassie, well, she wasn't necessarily not going to have one, but her path would be different from mine. Without anybody saying so outright, I was being told that my path was the more valuable. I got that from my parents and from Mr. Cartwright when he chose me for speech team, and from my teachers when they patted me on the back and gave me good grades, and from my grandmother, who, when she asked me about Cassie at Thanksgiving and I told her we'd been drifting apart, caressed my cheek with her shiny hand that smelled of rose water and said, "It's hard growing up, because each of us must follow our own star," which was, of itself, pretty neutral, but then she added, "And some of us have brighter stars to follow than others, I'm afraid." And if we were growing up and growing up differently now, and if there was some faintly ominous sense about the adolescence and adulthood that lay before us, as if there'd inevitably be a cull along the way, and drugs or violence or car crashes or general misfortune, or for the girls, the folly of careless sex or the evils of predatory men who lurked, unidentifiable as guerrilla fighters, among us, then the unspoken cry that echoed from all sides was, "Save yourself," because it was clear that it was the only thing you could hope to do. And even that might be impossible.
There. Thank you. The public reaction to the woman upstairs, it was such a blockbuster.
So if anybody has a question,
yeah,
I'm happy
to
answer
me.
It.
I'm wondering how you felt.
I'm supposed to ask if was it a blockbuster? that's great news. I didn't know. I mean, I think it's a funny thing. I don't really know. I don't know what someone outside's impression of what the response, I know what my experience was, which was sort of inside. And I was struck by so The Woman Upstairs was my last novel, and it was narrated by a woman named Nora. And in fact, it's about her friendship. She's an elementary school teacher who makes art, and she befriends a woman who is a professional artist, if you will. The woman and her family are visiting Cambridge, Massachusetts for a year. There are various things I'd say. One is that it divided people. I think there were people. I remember before the book was published, being at an event in Boston for booksellers, and a woman came up to me and said, "I'm so glad you wrote that book. I am Nora. It's amazing to find my story told, and I feel I've never heard it told. And thank you." And then sort of 10 minutes later, another woman walked up to me and she said, "I don't know why you wrote this book. Why would you write this depressing book?" She said, I can't stand that woman. I can't imagine anyone who could stand her. And frankly, I can't give this to my daughter, because why would I give my daughter this, my young, my sort of daughter of 20, why would I want to give her this impression of what it is, this is what it's like to be a woman?" And I was sorely tempted to say, "Excuse me, ma'am, maybe you guys could get together and have a conversation." But that was a sort of prefiguring of sort of my experience of the response to the book was that that people had that and for me it was interesting. For me it was it was sort of a departure because I felt all the things that as a teacher you tell your students, like you're in the service of the story, you know, you have to let your ego go and da da da. You know, like really, right? But I really felt like I had, to the best of my ability, sort of recorded the voice of this character who had been in my head, and that then it wasn't up to me. Then it was up to people to have their own responses, and I really felt that I didn't need people to say, "Hey, I really liked it." In a way that up to that point, I'd always secretly hoped people would say, "I really liked your book." I felt really fine about people saying, "I hated your book," you know. But just an aside, I think another element of it was that I had this funny exchange in an interview that was actually conducted by email, an excerpt of which then I think became what people knew about the book, which was about this question of dislikable characters and about Nora as a dislikable character. And I just want to stand up and say, you know, I don't dislike Nora. I couldn't have spent years writing her if I disliked her. But clearly lots of people did and probably do. But I was but I think then the book became a sort of reference point in a general broader discussion about whether in fiction characters and in particular women characters have a need to be likable, and that was a sort of conversation that I wasn't so much part of as listening interestedly on the sidelines.
Yeah. Thank you. Hi. On the subject of your last book, which was a blockbuster for me personally, I think about it often, actually, and I was wondering what your motivation for the story was, and the particular part of that whole idea, and I think it's a familiar theme that comes up now with Instagram and social media, the whole idea of women being sort of obsessed with other women and their lives. And I was wondering, and it's such a big part of the book, I was just would love to hear a little bit more about what inspired you for that element of it.
There's not, in a way, a simple answer. Mm-hmm. I was very. It was a thing I hadn't said to anybody, and then I said it to Ruth Franklin, who wrote a piece in the New York Times. So now I feel like I've said it to the whole world. But part of one of the composting inspirations was my aunt's life and my father's sister, who never married, and took care of her. Took care of her parents, my grandparents, until their deaths. And as far as we knew, never had any love affairs at all. And then when she was still living, although I didn't say that I was looking at my grandfather's shelves and I came across this diary of hers. By the way, she is no longer living or I would not tell the story. And in which was the record basically, it was a diary over 10 years where she recorded being in love with one of her close friends, the brother of one of her close friends, and I mean, she would only see him once or twice a year. He was married. He lived on another continent. She would see him when he came to visit his sister. They would all go out for dinner, but for really the better part of a decade, she managed to from those very few points spin what was in her mind quite a rich and complicated relationship that was on some small level real and on some other level imaginary. So that was very moving and sort of sad to me. There's a broader conversation to be had about that. I feel she let go of that phantasmagorical romance in her early 40s. She was a very devout Catholic who'd been brought up to believe that a woman's role was to marry and have children. And I don't think she ever wanted to marry and have children. And I think, but I don't think that was admissible to herself. And I think that the safest way to avoid that was to be passionately in love with somebody who was as unattainable mm-hmm. as they could possibly be. And part of the, you know, in the diary, she wrote about going on, she'd go out on dates with people, they'd invite her out, and she'd say, but he's nothing compared to, you know, that guy, like that guy I really love, you know. I think it served a purpose in her life, but I digress. But the degree to which, I mean, there's Lady with the Little Dog, the Chekhov story, there's a moment when Gurov, the man who's having an affair with the lady with the little dog, is obsessed with her. He can't sort of let go of what's going on, and he thinks about her all the time. And he's walking his child to school, and he thinks to himself, isn't it strange that the thing that matters to me most in my whole life, nobody knows about? And then his second thought is, that's true for everybody. And that is true for everybody. And so for me, the book was the Woman Upstairs is a lot about that experience, about and that I haven't answered your question, I realize, which is about why women and I think I think that one of the things that I've been aware of much of my adult life, and if I think back to The Emperor's Children, in which there's a character named Danielle and her good friend Marina, and Danielle falls in love. She has an affair with Marina's father, but she falls in love with the whole family, and part of it is having fallen in love in some way with Marina at university, and thinking that, not in the sense I want to go to bed with this person, but in the sense I want to be that person. I want that life. That's who I want to be. And I think the complexities of female friendship, there is almost always, I mean, we become friends with people because we're attracted to them, because they're appealing to us. We're rarely able to sustain friendships with people who are repulsive to us, right? So, you know, you're drawn to somebody and in some way that seems so central to the ways that women order our lives around those attractions that can be very intense, whether or not they're sexual, you know, they can be very intense. And so I wanted, and Nora too isn't, she's in love with her friend Serena, but she's in love with the whole family too, and it's the life she would have dreamed of having.
Thank you.
That was a long answer, I'm sorry. Anybody else?
Could you please tell us a little bit about your process, how you choose subjects, and once you've done that, how do you go about developing what? Where does it come from? I mean, what do you hear? What do you know? What is your thread? How do you follow that?
It's such a good question to which I have no good answer. I think just as it's different for each writer, I think with each book it's different. And say with The Woman Upstairs, my last book, what is the first chapter, which is this sort of Nora ranting at the reader, was literally it just came as a voice in my head, and I wrote it down, and it was longer and rantier, and I had to kind of try and contain it. But then I had to ask myself, who is this woman, and why is she yelling in my ear? And that's, you know, that in this case, with this book, I think the impulses were more considerate in a way. I was more conscious of certain things. It didn't seem like my id was yelling, you know, was just sort of having a go. There was some superego involved. And I think in this case, I did want to, you know, part of what I was trying to do is write almost a fable of American girls' adolescence, something that's archetypal. There's a lot of references to Greek myth. Only one person has noticed officially that I called a character Cassandra. So like, if I like, well, how big a hammer do I have to have? But it was wanting to do, I mean, the way I would perhaps, I was not long ago watching again the documentary about Nina Simone, and I thought, it's like jazz. I wanted to have a simple melody that then has these riffs. But in any case, in any book that I write, I'm somebody, there are lots of things that I care a lot about: sentences, music, thoughts, meaning. But it's people. People are what I care most about. So until I have a sense of who my characters are, and that involves also a sense of place, because we are who we are, because we are where we are when we are, and because of all the places we were before we were here. So until I have some sense of those people, then I don't have a way to proceed, if that makes sense. So it's about trying to figure out who the people are. And you know, that I can't answer. I've like that literally, there's a lot of napping involved, which is a problem, you know, in a life with kids or in a life where you teach, is suddenly there's not enough napping. I'm a believer in the sort of trickling thing. Hi, thank you.
Hi. I guess this is a comment more than I want to thank you. That section you read about the young girl becoming aware of needing protection and what that means in her life. And I've read the book, and I've been very struck by that. I'm a grandmother with granddaughters, and it's really made me think about and be aware of when this will happen to them and the impact of it. It's really terrific. And the other thing it's done, it's made me talk to women my age about when we discovered that, and of course it was a different time, and how we felt about it. And I think we obviously were aware of it, but it was different. I'll end by saying that I read recently and came to admire this so much that you made an actual conscious decision not to learn to cook. And I congratulate you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't know that the rest of my family can, but my husband's a really good cook, so that's my good fortune. He's a really good cook. I can scramble an egg. I can make a salad. I can make chocolate chip cookies. Like, do you need more than that? That's it. That's all you need. I can roast a chicken, but I can't. My mom was a very serious cook who had a massive cookbook collection and made very elaborate 3-course meals every night. And she wasn't very happy. So I think I felt like in some way and it was very interesting when I was growing up to read Joan Didion writing about, you know, those meals and realize that that was a sort of moment. That was that was a sort of post Julia Child moment where, everybody, that was a thing you were supposed to, among your many other accomplishments, that was a thing you were supposed to do, is whip up a 3-course meal, you know. La, here it is. Here's one I made earlier. And perhaps just, I also missed that moment, so there was less a sense of obligation. And I would thank you for the comment about the fear. I mean, I had a friend of mine said the other day, I gave a reading in Cambridge this past week, and this friend of mine came along, and somebody from the audience asked, could this be about a story about two boys? And I said, well, maybe, you know, it's about individuals and their intimacy, and there's no reason why it couldn't. And she said afterwards, that's nonsense, Claire. It couldn't be about two boys because there's a third character in this book, and that's fear. So I've been thinking about that, and I think it is really true that part of, I mean, I wouldn't have put it in the book if I didn't think it was true, but the degree to which girls' lives become circumscribed without any of us really being aware of it. I became, when my daughter was a few years ago, when she was sort of 12 and 13, I became, and I was working on this book, and I became sort of obsessed with the ubiquity of violence against girls and women in the narratives that permeate our culture, whether they are fictional narratives or whether they are news narratives, and it's just, if you actually say let me chart this for the next 3 weeks, it's actually really terrifying, and the question is, you know, I don't know if anybody, I have an intermittent vice of looking at the Daily Mail online, which is a very despicable very despicable, trashy tabloid newspaper. But if you look at the Daily Mail online, you think that all female school teachers across America are having affairs with their young male students, right? Do you, like, it's like, really? And, but they never report a male teacher having an affair with a female student. It's sort of, it's a narrative that they choose to perpetuate. I don't know who they send out into the nation to find, you know, the rare school teacher who is guilty of this. But I feel that I have some sense that the general prevalence of violence against women is actually a narrative that serves it's serving somewhat. You know that thing like somebody's getting rich? I feel like that narrative is serving someone in our culture to keep telling women to be afraid.
Do you ever write in French? Have you found your French voice, or is that totally apart?
You know, when I was at I don't really write much in no. The short answer is no. When I was in college, I studied in France for a bit, and I took a creative writing class at the University of Paris, and it was very thrilling to write in French then. It's fraught. So for everybody else, my father was French, so my I had French. My that aunt I was talking about was French. My grandparents were French, and they were a particular sort of traditional French. You know, I think it comes up in Lost Illusions. Lucien, there's a whole thing of like, is his French good enough? You know, there's a whole. I mean, the French have a whole hierarchy of the use of the language, and il parle un bon français, il parle un très bon français, right? Like, and if you don't speak a good French, don't bother. So I think I always had the sense if I couldn't write a good, you know, if it was just going to be, you know, my grandfather used to correct my letters in red ink and send them back. And
well, did they ever translate your books in French?
Yes, they do. They do. Okay. Yeah.
Hi, I was really struck by the voice of, is it Julie or Julia?
Julia. Called in the British press repeatedly Juliet, but yeah.
Okay. and its sophistication for perhaps a junior in high school, is that right?
She's just about to be a senior.
Just about to be a senior. Well, I'm sure that makes all the difference. But when I think back to high school and those I was with, and granted it was two or three generations, five generations ago, I remember sarcasm, but I don't remember subtle irony, wonderful humor. She seems so sophisticated to me. And I wonder to what extent that was a really conscious choice on your part as you thought through who she was and what kind of a voice did she have? How did she tell a story?
So it's something that I feel the answer is. I have many versions of the answer, many different answers. Yes, I thought long and hard about Julia's voice, I wanted her to be that age and not 5 years older, for a number of reasons. One of them being that. There was that little Wordsworth reference, "Trailing clouds of glory." I wanted her still to have some version of a child's worldview, a fable-like worldview, a world in which animals are symbolic or are actors, in which you don't question why. There are certain narrative oddities that you don't question why. So I needed for her not to be older. I don't think. Living with my teenage daughter, who was one of the first readers and did correct some of the dialogue and so on, I don't think that I have given Julia thoughts or experiences that she wouldn't have. I actually think young people are a lot more sophisticated than we often, certainly as parents, want to believe. But I think it was a conscious decision to make her perhaps more articulate or more directly articulate than she might be. You know, there was, I think it was the, the review in the New York Times said, you know, these are thoughts and feelings that I recognize, but I would never have expressed them that way. To which my husband's response was, is that not what a work of art is? So I think I took certain liberties, but I was conscious of doing so, and I did them for a reason. Yeah.
Hi. So you've already touched on this a little bit, but I was thinking, I'm only halfway through, but I was thinking about Julia and her similarities to Nora and to Danielle, to being this woman who's like sort of has another woman kind of on a pedestal that she's looking at, and thinking about how I think that's probably a really common narrative, but it's not that prevalent in fiction. I don't even know if there's necessarily a word for it. And then I was like, well, what percentage of women are the one like Julia or Nora or Danielle? Like, is it 50-50, right? Because there's always a woman on the other side. And is this something that has been, and maybe this is too personal to ask, but a part of your own personal narrative, like having really admired and sort of wanted to be another woman at some point in your life, or not want to be, but you know what I
right,
mean?
Right, right.
Or do you... have you ever sort of surveyed friends or other women? And it's just, I think it's something that is really interesting, and I see it in your fiction, but I don't necessarily see it elsewhere. And maybe I do. But I love that story because I connect a lot to it, and I think other people do.
Well, thank you. I think that all of us, how would I know? But I'm going to assert that all of us at some point is either Cassie or Julia, that we have both experiences. You know, I have many memories of revering, you know, girls I thought were so much cooler and funnier and more interesting than I was. And I also have the terrible memory of, you know, friends I remember, and I went to boarding school, and I remember on Valentine's Day opening my mailbox, And there was a Valentine inside, and I took it out, and I was with a few friends, and I said, oh, it's just from Meg. That's the same as having no Valentine at all. And turning around, and there was Meg, right? Aww. Meg heard me say that. And Meg was an incredibly loyal, devoted friend of mine who I was really fond of, but I would never have sent Meg a Valentine. That was a terrible, as you can see, still now, terrible, terrible moment. All these years later, yep, that was 1982. I think we all inhabit various roles in different relationships, and I think most of us have been in both situations, you know, over time. The other thing I would say is that just narratively, it is a storytelling framework with a long history. The example that comes most readily to mind is *Brideshead Revisited* by Evelyn Waugh, in which Charles Ryder is the narrator and is telling the story of his glamorous friend Sebastian Flight, Ryder. Flight, you know, and basically the role of the storyteller is always to be the observer of the more glamorous, exciting person. Sebastian Flight can't tell his story; he's doing too many things, and eventually he's too drunk. But that in a way is the story of the good soldier. Ford Madox Ford's *The Good Soldier* has a similar. But there are many versions. Gatsby, right? Gatsby. I mean, it's a very common setup. The writers of the world. Those of us who aren't flying, we got to have some. We got to get a perk somewhere. Right? Got to get to tell the stories. So.
I wonder how you feel, you know, in your achievement as a writer, and. Where would you like to be? Where would you like to go? Or are you content?
How do I feel about my achievement as a writer? It's a really, I mean, I think back to myself at 20. I decided as a kid, when I found out that writing stories was a thing people did when I was about 5, that's what I decided I wanted to do. I was given a typewriter by my parents when I was 6, a kid's typewriter, because I said that's what I wanted to do. So it's the only thing I ever really wanted to do. But at 20, I think on the one hand I had absurd ambitions and fantasies and also no sense how I would ever earn a living, say. And I think one of the things of, I had a mother who, both my parents were avid readers. My mother in particular was a great lover of 20th century women writers. She could have, her library was the gender studies, syllabus. And she gave me all those books to read, but I was also aware of the lives of the women who wrote them. Christina Stead in Age, eating baked beans out of a tin in a bedsit in North London, Jean Rhys drunk in Cornwall, hearing her obituary on the radio, and calling up and saying, "Well, actually, I'm not dead." It was not a choice. And I felt very strongly at that age, if you want to be a writer, you can't fall in love and you can't have children because that will be the end of you. So I fell in love and I have children and I've written some books and they're not Shakespeare, but I've done, I do the best I can, and I'm aware how incredibly privileged I am to do that and to do something that I love and to have it to look forward to. So I feel like it would be great to be Shakespeare, but I'm grateful every day for the blessings that I have, and I think, as anybody here who does something that you love, even on a bad day, it's pretty good. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Claire. That was really wonderful.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.